Hello there. This is the Takeaway Podcast. I'm John Hockenberry, and on behalf of the entire team, we hope you enjoy the program.
If prayer were made of sound, the skies over England that night would have deafened the world. Captains paced their decks, pilots tapped their gauges. Commanders pored over maps, fully aware that for all the months of meticulous planning, everything could go wrong. The winds, the tides, the element of surprise, and above all, the audacious bet that what waited on the other side of the channel would compel men not to shrink away, but to charge ahead.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, and we begin today at the American Cemetery at Omaha Beach in France, where President Obama and French President François Hollande stood alongside veterans to mark the 70th anniversary of D-Day. Of course, the anniversary comes at a time of renewed tension between old allies in Europe, but in the early summer sunshine, leaders of the United States, Canada, Europe, and Russia put aside their differences to honor the moment when their predecessors joined forces to liberate a continent from tyranny.
We don't just honor sacrifice, as grateful as the world is. We come to remember why America and our allies gave so much for the survival of liberty at this moment of maximum peril. We come to tell the story of the men and women who did it, so that it remains seared into the memory of a future world.
President Obama there, and we'll take you back to Normandy later this hour, and we'll hear some sound of some people who were there as the world pauses today to remember. Of course, after 70 years, firsthand accounts of the events of D-Day continue to slip away from our collective national memory. Of the 16 million Americans who served their country in the Second World War, just over a million remain today. Many of their stories have never been told. Young men returning home in the middle of the 20th century largely fell silent about their experiences of war. But decades later, a lot of that changed for the men of Easy Company. That's the 506th Parachute Infantry Regiment of the 101st Airborne Division. The landing at Normandy was just one battle of many that the company fought across Europe during World War II. And historian Stephen Ambrose documented their story in his 1992 book, Band of Brothers. And it was screenwriter Eric Jenderson, along with Steven Spielberg and Tom Hanks, who transformed that book into what became one of the most acclaimed HBO miniseries of all time.
Standing in the door, I could see the lights on a drop zone way in the, ahead of us. We had the red light. I had everybody standing up, ready to jump. So when the plane started to get hit, and suddenly the pilot gives me the green light, I'm out the door immediately.
That's Easy Company paratrooper Major Richard Winters, one of the main characters of the television show as well, recalling the moments before he jumped from his plane to the beaches of Normandy on this day 70 years ago. Eric Jenderson, lead writer and supervising producer for Band of Brothers, began his years-long mission to tell the story of Easy Company by sitting down with the then-living Winters in his Pennsylvania home. It was the first of hundreds of conversations they would have.
The first step from my job as lead writer and supervising producer was to assemble everything and to craft what's called a Bible for the series. And in order to do that, my first stop was in Hershey, Pennsylvania, where I met Major Richard Winters.
Who my hometown, as a matter of fact.
Seriously?
Yes.
Well, that's a coincidence. Well, this is where Winters had retired. We met, and it was the beginning of an extraordinary friendship. Genuinely a sort of a life-changing friendship, I think, for both of us in a lot of ways. Subsequently, over the course of the next 3 years, there was scarcely a day that we didn't speak. But when I went to Hershey, I went up to his office upstairs in his little house. And the very first thing he did was he shoved a piece of paper across the table toward me. It was a letter from the daughter of one of the members of Easy Company, because unfortunately Stephen Ambrose had made a mistake in his book. And he had identified this particular soldier as somebody who had disobeyed a direct order during the Battle of the Bulge. And it had destroyed him when the book came out. He was just absolutely distraught. And Winters was still the commanding officer of this company without question, even in retirement. And so this particular soldier's daughter had written to him an appeal. Is there anything you could do to help? And Winters simply slid this letter across his desk toward me and watched me read it. And he wanted to see what my reaction would be. And I said, well, I guess the first order of business is going to be to correct this. The materials that Richard Winters handed over to me on that day in Hershey, when I actually stacked them up at my home and measured them, it was a 6-foot-high pile of paperwork. There were S2 reports and intelligence reports and journal entries and letters. And my initial job was to go through all of that material and sort of start from scratch and recreate day by day, moment by moment, exactly what had happened from the time most of these guys arrived in Toccoa to the moment when the war ended.
You know, Eric Jenerson, one of the things that sort of happens sometimes in the writing of war history or making of programs about war history is a tendency to deify the soldiers and the officers and the people involved in the story. And I was struck always with the fact that you didn't really do that. Of course, there is a lot of heroism and that's portrayed, but there's also a lot of reality of war, shooting of prisoners and horrible things that went on that don't deify what is the Greatest Generation.
It's a great question. If there was any guiding principle or phenomena that came out of the creation of this series, creatively, everyone involved, and particularly the writers, were so dedicated to serving the story of these guys. And to answer your question, the reason why no one is deified and we stuck so close, assiduously, to the truth was because these gentlemen themselves, these veterans, these members of Easy Company, would never have stood for it. And we were trying to serve their experience. These are guys who famously, I mean, if anybody is talking about the Battle of the Bulge and how it was, you know, there was 3 feet of snow or the snow was up to your knees, they'd say, no, it wasn't. It was about 18 inches.
Well, let's hear from another one of the members of Easy Company. This is Bill Maynard, who was also a paratrooper who jumped into Normandy.
In the back of your mind, you wonder what's going to happen and all that. You know, you've been trained and trained and trained and what your job is going to be and what you're supposed to do. And that's what you got to think about, you know. And we lost a lot of people that night. But you try to put it all out of your mind.
It can be a little bit difficult when you're watching the young men portrayed by the actors in battle, talking to each other, smoking cigarettes and being young men, connecting them to the real old men who speak for real in Band of Brothers.
The show aired in 2001. And Saving Private Ryan had come out, I guess, 2 years prior and had sort of cracked open a door for a lot of old gentlemen of that Greatest Generation. The men who came back from World War II, these sons of the Depression, who knew that their relatives, their mothers, their fathers, their aunts and uncles, had no frame of reference for understanding what their experience had been. So they were unable to articulate it. And so almost to a man, the vast majority of these gentlemen, all suffering from various forms of combat trauma without question, they just fell silent. And many families had no idea that their grandfather or their father had participated in this grand event. And Saving Private Ryan kind of cracked open the door and Band of Brothers sort of kicked it open. And what happened as a result was most of these gentlemen who were in their early 80s, late 70s, early 80s at that time, were able, for the first time in many cases, to point to that and say, okay, you see that? Let me explain what I had to do with it. And it changed families because it gave them something. It gave them a way to talk about it.
Memory, of course, is always plastic. It's never perfect. And over the years, it gets worse and worse, even when the events are so very vivid. Did you have any concerns with the vets that you were talking about, that their detailed stories were, in fact, accurate rather than just sort of watercolored impressions?
I didn't. It's a great question, and I had never really thought about that. But in retrospect, it was astonishing how accurate these gentlemen were in terms of their memory. And I know that for a fact because I was constantly cross-referencing stories with the point of view of somebody else who was there at the same time. And it was pretty amazing. Unfortunately, I think I should also point out that in the case of these gentlemen, I'm not sure that there wasn't a single one of them who wasn't in some way suffering from the effects of combat and what that does to your memory. They dealt with it, and some of them, the few remaining gentlemen, still do deal with it in ways that are different from how we are attempting to, you know, address this problem of what we call PTSD. But for so many of these men, the memories lived and continued to live with them, and they were very, very present. They never really went away. So those memories were so vivid still because they were traumatic. And, you know, there's always this attempt to make sense of what you have experienced. And in every sense, from the moment their Corcorans hit the soil in Normandy to the end of the war, what they experienced was highly unusual and highly traumatic. The single event that almost none of them wished to speak of, and they did everything to avoid speaking of it, was the discovery of the prison camp at Landsberg. Because, again, for them, they had no frame of reference for all of these men and women who'd been rounded up and were being held for no other reason than they were Jews or gypsies. They couldn't understand that. There was no frame of reference for that. And it scared them. And it bothered them so deeply. With all of the tragedies and the traumas that they'd experienced and everything they'd witnessed, that was the one thing that they still were completely unable to digest.
We're now in 2014 on the tail end of two wars that were in fact longer than World War II, much less bloody, of course. What's the legacy, do you think, now of all these soldiers and officers, veterans that you talk to? When you view it in the context of the wars that the United States has spent the last 12 or 13 years enduring?
It's a complex thing. I think that the lesson of leadership, the lessons of strength of character and toughness, but principally the notion of follow me, that the greatest generation learned and the way they executed themselves in World War II, to some extent has been an inspiration for soldiers to join up. It's been a recruiting tool, unfortunately, because I don't think any of these vets would look at what's happening right now, the way in which our military is trained and how they're deployed with an approving eye. And so there's a tremendous irony to that, that it caused more young men and women to want to join up and to experience the hell that is war.
Eric Jenderson was lead writer and supervising producer for the acclaimed HBO miniseries Band of Brothers, came out in 2001. He began research on it as far back as 1998. Eric Jenderson, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much, Todd.
You know, after that conversation, I had the chance to have a long conversation of my own in private with Eric Jenderson. And he told me about how he eulogized Richard Winters 3 years ago upon his death in Hershey, Pennsylvania, in fact, in the very theater where my high school graduation was. Tom Ridge, the governor of Pennsylvania, former governor, was there, and the surviving members of Easy Company. Jenderson said that Winters always signed off every conversation with, "I'll be here." And maybe now, in remembrance on the 70th anniversary and after the production of Band of Brothers, the conceit there is that Richard Winters is still with us.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International, in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Well, all week, Americans have debated the release of five Taliban prisoners from Guantanamo Bay in exchange for the release of American soldier Bo Bergdahl. Now, that debate is focused in some quarters on the implied question of whether Bo Bergdahl was worth rescuing at all. In terms of U.S. policy, it's been about what the swap means for Americans and whether, as Senator John McCain told me earlier this week, those prisoners were too dangerous to release.
I have never known of an exchange of prisoners that involved this kind of individuals, these five, who are wanted for war crimes.
And there's also been the question, as journalist Vanessa Ghazari told us, of whether Americans should have really been surprised that these releases were going to take place.
I do think that this shouldn't come out completely out of nowhere for people. There's no way we can keep folks in Guantanamo forever, even though there is this thing called indefinite detention. and we can't kill all of them. So the idea that we would ultimately talk to them and that some of them would go back under various circumstances, either to Qatar or to ultimately to Afghanistan, is not that surprising.
So two American perspectives there among many that have flooded the airwaves and newspapers all week. But what are people saying about the deal in Afghanistan, where these five Taliban officials are going to be, presumably, after a year? Are regular Afghans afraid that these officials are returning to their country, or are they responding with more of a shrug? Here to discuss the Taliban figure's release in the prisoner swap and the Afghan reaction to the deal is Saad Mohseini. He's director of the Mobi Group. That's one of Afghanistan's largest media companies. Mr. Mohseini, welcome back.
Hi, Todd.
You know, did anyone in Afghanistan, Saad, know who Bo Bergdahl was before last Saturday?
Well, we had heard the name because you have to understand that the swap has been, has been discussed for some years now.
Yeah,
it stalled. When the Taliban established a pseudo embassy in Qatar, but we have been discussing this for some years, and I think that we were ready that there was going to be some sort of a deal with the Taliban with these five prisoners in Guantanamo.
So one American soldier leaving Afghanistan isn't a big story because thousands are leaving. But five Taliban officials who've been held in Guantanamo for 13 years is a big deal. What's the reaction been like?
Well, the reaction is a combination of anger and confusion, because you have to understand that we have had a very similar issue inside of Afghanistan, where there was a prison in Bagram just outside of Kabul, where a number of Taliban prisoners were freed by the Afghan government. And they were much lower level Taliban commanders. And the U.S. government, through the military and the embassy, and of course folks in Washington, went nuts, questioning as to why the Afghan government would just release these prisoners. And here you have the Americans doing the exact same thing with Taliban officials who are much higher in rank and much more responsible from an Afghan perspective for crimes against humanity, for terrorist acts. So people are just confused as to why the Americans would do the exact thing that they have condemned in the past.
I would think that the reaction to the release of these five, in particular Mullah Mohammed Fazl, who's judged in all quarters to be potentially a war criminal and very dangerous, that the reaction in Kabul would be very different from the reaction in the provinces, where maybe he's a lot more popular.
Well, you have to understand the Taliban are not popular. We conducted a pretty comprehensive survey, a national survey. Their approval rating, if you would call it that, is less than 10% nationally. Even in the south, where a lot of Taliban members come from, it's certainly less than it's in the 20s. So they're not popular at all, and I think that at this stage, a lot of people feel that with the Americans drawing down, what is the intention? Why would you release these five prisoners with no conditions? Afghans do tend to believe in conspiracy theories, and there is, some quarters, the feeling is, are the Americans looking to strengthen the Taliban movement at a higher level as they draw down? So it has caused a lot of confusion, and of course, people are not happy at all.
And Afghanistan is, of course, involved in its own political transition as the Americans pull out. And conspiracy theories aside, it must give a lot of Afghans the distinct impression that in addition to pulling out our armed forces, the United States is kind of leaving Afghanistan to its own to struggle with the same Taliban that it struggled with for so many years.
That's correct. I mean, this combined with President Obama's statement that the Afghans really have to take care of things on their own reinforces this notion we've had for some time that as the Americans draw down, what the Americans would have viewed as something very important, those principles no longer apply. It's a question now that we're going to pull out all our people, deserters, normal soldiers, whatever, and you can have your Taliban back, and this is your problem from going forward.
Anxiety, nervousness, and it sounds like a high degree of anger among Afghans at the release of five Taliban officials in exchange for American soldier Bo Bergdahl, the Afghan perspective on that prisoner swap. Saad Mohseini, director and chairman of the Mobi Group, one of Afghanistan's largest media companies. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Later in the hour, we'll be talking with the longtime host of Reading Rainbow, the legendary LeVar Burton, about his Kickstarter campaign to relaunch his popular children's program. But first, I want to remind you to read along with our Takeaway Book Club series. It officially kicks off next week with our first book, To Rise Again at a Decent Hour, by Joshua Ferris, and our first book club, and that's a group of guys in Portland, Oregon. Of course, even if you don't have your own book club, we want you to take part anyway. You can text book club to 69866 to join the discussion, or call us at 8778-MY-TAKE with your questions and thoughts on the book. Some of you have already started reading To Rise Again at a Decent Hour. Here's the author, Joshua Ferris, describing his main character, Dr. Paul C. O'Rourke.
Well, he's a dentist. He's 40 years old, and he has all of the material comfort and trappings that he could want. But he's at great odds with the city and with his patients who refuse to floss, and with his employees who refuse to go along with his prescriptions, and kind of with the universe as a whole. He's sort of raised both fists at the universe.
Jenna Ramis from Rowlett, Texas was a fan.
I loved it. It had great perspective, and it really spoke to me in how he was always asking what other people were doing, but never asking them. That really spoke to me. And it was a very unique outlook on religion, which I appreciate it because you don't get that all the time.
So tune in next week to hear John discuss this book with our friends from Portland, Oregon, and text book club to 69866 to join that discussion. Of course, you can call us at 8778-MY-TAKE with your thoughts and questions about the book. We are commemorating the 70th anniversary of D-Day on this June 6th edition of The Takeaway. And joining me now from the beaches of Normandy is Jake Saganaro, correspondent for our sister program, PRI's The World. Hi, Jake.
Hi, Todd.
Well, help set the scene for us, if you would, from the beaches there in Normandy in the American Military Cemetery where so many of the ceremonies were going on.
Sure. Well, veterans and people who came to pay tribute to those veterans arrived en masse in buses to the beaches here in Normandy, just at the American Cemetery, Colville-sur-Mer. And it was a sunny and celebratory atmosphere with clear skies. But whenever the ceremony started, it became quite poignant and quite reverent.
In the pre-dawn hours, planes rumbled down runways. Gliders and paratroopers slipped through the sky. Giant screws began to turn on a armada that looked more like ships than sea. And more than 150,000 souls set off toward this tiny sliver of sand upon which hung more than the fate of a war, but rather the course of human history.
President Obama spoke. The President of France, François Hollande, spoke. Who else?
Those were the only two that spoke besides the prayer that was given. And the pastor who gave the prayer said that this day was not to fix blame of the past, but to set the course of the future, which I thought was quite an important point to make.
And in his remarks today, even though President Obama is there to commemorate the efforts and the valor of World War II veterans, were there any oblique allusions to the politics of the moment, to maybe what the United States sees as aggression in the East?
I can't say if there was actually direct reference to it, but Obama did push the message of unity in a world that he said is easy to follow self-endeavor, narrow self-endeavor, and slough off common interests, which I think might be a jab at Putin.
Sounds like it might be. Well, what about the veterans who are there? What are they saying about this day that's really about them?
You know, they've come today to remember the importance of the invasion to liberate Europe from Nazi Germany in 1944 during World War II. And they've come to honor their fallen comrades. And for them, I think this is quite a special moment because for many of them, this is the last time possibly, that they will attend a big memorial commemoration of D-Day, since many of them are in their late 80s and pushing 90.
Jake Singanero of The World, I wonder if after the media attention is done, you might have a minute or two to yourself to visit the American Military Cemetery and maybe reflect on your own without the microphones and the Secret Service around.
Todd, I would love to. I was out there this morning with the crowds, and even with everyone around, it was incredibly moving, and I can only imagine what it would be like to have a moment of solitude to say thank you in my own way among the headstones without all of the crowds.
Jake Siganero is a correspondent for our sister program, PRI's The World in France, helping us commemorate the 70th anniversary of D-Day. Jake, thank you.
Thank you, Todd.
Homeward bound, how the sweet expression will soon be whispered around when we hear the wonderful tidings that the boys are homeward bound. What a cry from a whisper growing till heaven rocks with the sound and the skies come back with the echo that the boys are homeward bound.
Tickets, please.
Well, it's a weekend and it's summer. It's a summer weekend, and that means there are new movies out. And lucky us, Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday, and Kristen Meinzer, culture producer here at The Takeaway and co-hosts of the Movie Date podcast, are here to guide us through our weekend movies. Hi, guys.
Hey,
hey,
how
Todd.
You doing, Todd?
We're going to start with the Tom Cruise vehicle, Edge of Tomorrow, and that got me to this week's trivia question. We're going to do trivia this time. In 2012, guys, Tom Cruise was in Jack Reacher. You remember that film?
I do.
Who played the villain in Jack Reacher? Keep that to yourself. And if you know the answer, I'm going to come back to you at the end. Kristen, first, Edge of Tomorrow. This is a Tom Cruise futuristic time travel movie. Let's listen to a clip.
Come on! The ship is going to explode! What are you doing?
Find me when you wake up.
What?
Come find me when you wake up.
Kristen, I know how much you usually love things where ships explode.
Well, I really love time travel movies, actually. And this is kind of like Groundhog Day meets Saving Private Ryan meets The Terminator. We're in the future. We're killing aliens. But every single day we wake up to the same scenario as the day before. And our star, of course, is Tom Cruise. He's this cocky PR guy who's never been on the front lines. And the person who really knows what's going on, the super soldier, is played by Emily Blunt. And it's ridiculous, and as long as you don't think about logic and you can just enjoy how stupid it is, you might have some fun.
Rafer, does $175 million make Groundhog Day meets Tom Cruise watchable?
It is pretty stupid, I have to say, this movie. One great thing about it is, well, first of all, Tom Cruise, who I think, you know, at 51 is still a really great action hero. The movie really crackles. The action scenes are fantastic, but it does not make one single shred of sense throughout the entire film.
Don't think about it.
If you can sit there and enjoy it moment for moment, it's really good, but I think you will ultimately walk out of the theater just thinking, huh?
All right, well, let's move then from a big high-tech blockbuster to something a little more organic. We got to go over to Sweden for this. I'm excited about the possibility of We Are the Best, a story of young girls starting their own punk band. Listen.
Så snälla ta mig dit där man får göra som man vill. Jag såg dig dö i höstas och jag tror jag följer med.
Need a little Swedish translation there, Kristen Meinzer, but once you get it, how's this one?
This is great. It's just one of the most honest depictions I've ever seen of girls who are in seventh grade. This is in the 1980s. It's in Sweden. These girls are like children in some ways, catching snowflakes on their tongues, and like teenagers in other ways, trying to figure out how to talk to boys. It's just really great girl friendship and great punk music. I really thought it was fun.
And then we have kind of a teen love story with a twist, as I said at the top, A Fault in Our Stars. Rafer, what'd you think?
Well, this is the story about Shailene Woodley, who plays a 16-year-old cancer survivor, and she meets a very handsome young guy in her cancer support group named Augustus Water, played by Ansel Elgort. So the twist is that they are both essentially dying, and they form a bond. It's based on a young adult novel that was hugely successful. It is very moving. There are some very nice moments in it. I think it is a little disingenuous the way that keeps saying this is going to be the brutal truth. This is going to be the real story, not the Hollywood version. But it really is the Hollywood version. And if it had been a little more honest about that, I would have liked it a little better, I think.
Kristen, you usually love a love story.
Oh, I do. I was sobbing through this whole thing. I just loved it. I just went with it. You know, let's feel love. Let's feel love's loss. Let's feel first love. Let's all die. What's not to love in this? I was crying and crying and crying. After the movie, I said to Rafer, I'm not sure if you heard the hysterical woman in the back of the theater crying. And he said to me, well, I'm not sure if you heard the man in the front folding his arms with the Groaning, rustling of his shirt fabric. So that kind of tells you how we feel.
All right. That's The Fault in Our Stars. And I want to go back to trivia, which we mentioned at the top. Tom Cruise in 2012 starred in Jack Reacher. My question for you was, who was the baddie villain? Now, my goal here usually, Kristen, is to stump you.
Oh, I have this one, though, Todd. I have it. Because I love that Werner Herzog, and I loved Jack Reacher.
Kristen Meinzer, for once, is right.
I was in prison in Siberia. I spent my first winter wearing a dead man's coat.
The great documentarian Werner Herzog shows up as the baddie in Jack Reacher. That's Kristen Meinzer. She is co-host of the Movie Date podcast, along with Rafer Guzman, who is also co-host of the Movie Date podcast and film critic for Newsday. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Todd.
Butterfly in the sky. I can go twice as high. Take a look. It's in a book. A reading rainbow.
For an entire generation of kids, that song was the soundtrack of childhood learning and a song that they can sing to you on cue. Of course, that's the theme song to the educational program Reading Rainbow. Now, Reading Rainbow ran on PBS from 1983 until 2009, picking up a Peabody Award and only 26 Emmys along the way. No big deal. But with educational program leaving TV for tablets and apps, Reading Rainbow is looking to make the switch too.
I'm here on Kickstarter so that together we can bring Reading Rainbow back for every child, everywhere. We're creating an unlimited library of books and video field trips for today's digitally connected kids, delivered through browsers right into schools and homes everywhere. And I want to make this completely free to classrooms in need.
That's LeVar Burton, longtime host and executive producer of Reading Rainbow. Of course, you also remember him as Geordi LaForge on Star Trek Next Generation. Well, his Kickstarter campaign for Reading Rainbow blew past the original goal of $1 million in less than a day. And as of this morning, they've raised over $3.5 million from nearly 78,000 individuals. $5 million is the new goal for Reading Rainbow. And LeVar Burton himself is in the studio with me. Welcome.
Todd, how you feel?
I don't feel as good as you, having raised so much money so quickly. I noticed on Twitter today, LeVar, you said that it was on this day in 1983 when Reading Rainbow debuted.
That's right. Today is the 31st birthday of Reading Rainbow. Our first episode, June 6th, was Tight Times, based on a book about a young kid whose father loses his job. The story is about how the family deals with that. I think it's as relevant today as it was back in 1983 when it first aired.
And 31 years later now, you're trying to make a major transition from a show that not only was on television, but was on a kind of old-style television of PBS to a whole new platform.
Today's kids are technological natives, and if you want to reach kids today, you've got to, you know, reach them where they are. Just the same way we did back in the 80s with Reading Rainbow. I mean, television was the technology that we used then to reach kids. So as far as I'm concerned, we're doing the same thing that we've always done. It's just that the medium has changed.
You know, I G-chatted a friend this morning who's overseas, and I said, hey, I get to talk to LeVar Burton this morning. Did you ever watch Reading Rainbow as a kid? She said, watch it. I was on it.
Wow. Oh, who was that?
This was a friend of mine, a reporter named Lucy, who's from New York. And said
she did a book review?
I think she was a kid in the audience, or I'm not really sure. She said she was on the show in the 90s. It just made me think there is a generation of Gen Xers primarily and millennials, not only who watch the show but engaged with it on all these different levels.
Absolutely. And it is them who are responsible for the success of this Kickstarter campaign. Most of these donations have come in the $5, $10, $15 range, and it's really those first generations of Reading Rainbow watchers who have really stepped up in such a big way to make sure that succeeding generations have Reading Rainbow as a part of their lives as well.
Well, you know, with all of the debate, there's a huge amount of political debate now over kids' education. That's ongoing in this country. But things like Common Core and how we're going to educate kids in the public schools and whether it should be a mandate from Washington. Reading Rainbow is about, it strikes me, a very different kind of education. Not only reading, but learning how to sort of proactively read. It's about imagination. It's about reading that's kind of outside the classroom.
It's really about developing a love for reading, a passion for the written word. There are lots of programs and efforts that really focus on teaching our kids how to read. I think Reading Rainbow is fairly unique in that our focus has always been finding that spark in a child and fanning it into flame and making sure that they're a reader for life. Because if you can become a reader for life, then you have the wherewithal to educate yourself. We always say on the show, you don't have to take my word for it. And it really has become sort of an anthem for the generations who have really embraced the show in terms of, you know what, it's like LeVar says, I don't have to take anybody's word for it. I can find out for myself.
So $3.5 million in, $5 million is the goal by July 2nd.
Right.
How would Reading Rainbow on a tablet look? How would it feel? What would it be like?
Well, it's already on tablets. We released the Reading Rainbow app 2 years ago. And it's on the iPad and it's on the Kindle Fire. And what it is a library of books and video field trips with LeVar, just like the original television series. And we've had a fair amount of success. We're the number one educational app in the App Store. And we have kids coming to the app reading about 139,000 books a week, Todd. So we've proven yet again that our formula is solid, that it's sound. Kids will come to these very engaging devices to read, not simply to play games, but to read as well. And that's huge. So our intention, and this was the intention for the Kickstarter campaign, is to increase our footprint, right? We wanted to get the app on the web, and that would serve as a basis for our product designed specifically for classrooms so that teachers could use reading, this new incarnation of Reading Rainbow, in their everyday curriculum. And that first $1 million gives us the ability to do just that and give the product away, that's classroom product away, to 1,500 classrooms that are in need.
The overwhelming response on Kickstarter to your campaign suggests that Reading Rainbow fans are the biggest fans of your annals of work. Who are the biggest fans? Star Trek fans? Roots
Star
fans?
Star Trek fans are incredibly passionate about Trek. I'm a Star Trek fan. I understand that passion.
Well, you better be.
Roots fans, of course, are legion and cross all sorts of demographics. However, I have to say that it is Reading Rainbow fans who are the most active in my life right now, and they have overwhelmingly come to this campaign and contributed, made it really their own.
They've raised $3.5 million so far. The goal is $5 million by July 2nd.
And that additional money, allow me to just sort of fill you in on what we plan to do with that additional money should we reach $5 million. And that will go a long way toward ensuring that we have universal access. So the first million gets us to the web and into classrooms. The next goal then would be to broaden our reach in terms of platforms. It puts us on mobile. It puts us on gaming consoles. How many kids in America are on the Xbox or the PlayStation? It gets us on set-top boxes. It just gives us universal access and the ability to give it away to 7,500 classrooms.
That's LeVar Burton. He's the longtime host of Reading Rainbow, and he's launched that Kickstarter campaign. $5 million, as I mentioned, the goal by July 2nd to bring Reading Rainbow for free via app to classrooms all across America. What a pleasure, LeVar Burton.
Thank Todd, you. I appreciate you, man.
Since 1923, the Scholastic Art and Writing Awards have recognized the creative accomplishments of teenagers across the country. Now, listen to this list of previous winners. How about Truman Capote, Andy Warhol, Sylvia Plath, Lena Dunham? Ever heard of her? Well, our next guests are getting ready to join their ranks. With me in the studio is Ellie Braun. She's 17 years old. She's the gold medal winner at this year's Scholastic Art and Writing Awards. Ellie earned her medal in the drawing category. Hi, Ellie.
Hi.
Also with us in the studio is her fellow gold medalist, 18-year-old Jack Rayson, who won the writing portfolio category this year. Hi, Jack.
Hi.
You can see Ellie's drawings on thetakeaway.org and a link to Jack's writing portfolio, and everybody should do that so they can get a good sense of what we're talking about today. Welcome, guys.
Hi.
Well, must feel good, Ellie, to be a winner. I mean, I just listed some pretty heavy-hitting American artists.
Yeah, it's so surreal. I've never had this kind of experience. It's been amazing.
Well, let's talk a little bit about your work, Ellie, and well, Jack, we're going to talk about yours too. Ellie, I'm looking at your drawings, and they're colorful, and they're mostly of what appear to be, cross-dressing young men.
Yeah. I kind of was dealing with the idea of gender identity, and I wanted to bring to the table the stereotypes that go along with, you know, certain traits, masculine and feminine. And I was kind of just combining those two things and putting them on paper. And yeah, it was definitely like an evolution for me, because it started out a very simple idea, just makeup, costume. And then it really turned into something that was identity and true to me.
There's a great deal of joy in your work. I mean, there's a lot of smiling, there's cupcakes, there's color, and almost like a party.
Yeah. It's been a really personal experience for me. So I see myself sort of in all of the subjects that I work with.
Well, Jack Rayson, you're from Nashville, Tennessee.
Yep.
Just graduated high school. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Also in the ranks of Truman Capote and Sylvia Plath. So that's got to feel okay.
Yeah, it feels pretty nice.
I'm sure. Well, you have a short story that won, and it's called We Have Not Left You, Planet Earth. This is in the writing category. Help me understand sort of the scene. I'll set the scene just very briefly. The story is you as a 12-year-old riding with your parents in a minivan.
It's actually not a personal memoir. It's a 12-year-old girl, and she's riding in a minivan with her parents, and they're moving from Kentucky to California. And they hear on the radio that the first like manned mission to Mars has missed the planet, and it's just there's a little capsule of people floating off into space. The story doesn't take place when that happens. It's actually the narrator reflecting on that event, that kind of moment in a memory, and trying to process her thoughts.
One of those emotional moments when a person really can't forget how they were feeling and what they were doing at the time. You know, I read your story and space stories came to mind. I remember where I was in seventh grade when the Shuttle Challenger exploded.
A lot of that story came to me when we were talking in a class I was taking. It was after one of the anniversaries of 9/11, and I was in kindergarten at the time. And that's a pretty kind of abstract concept for a kindergartner to process. So it didn't hit me as hard as it did for adults, but I'm still old enough to have been alive and have memories of it from when it happened. So I'm kind of in this almost a gray area. And so a lot of the story, We Have Not Left You, Planet Earth, is this girl kind of surrounded by people who are kind of grieving all of a sudden. Like, she's on the highway in the middle of traffic, and all of a sudden she comes to this realization that pretty much everyone around her is crying, and she isn't. And she has this kind of moment of trying to justify why she isn't crying and why she isn't, like, feeling grief in any way.
Jack, your story in a lot of ways is about remembrances, and I just wanted to take a second, if I could. We're spending the day today remembering D-Day. Now, this is 70 years. It's an event that I don't remember I wasn't around, and neither were the two of you. Jack, I'm interested, though, in your reflections. Your story is about remembrances and about emotional remembrances.
Yes, it's very much about emotional remembrances because, I don't know, I'm more of an emotional thinker than an analytical thinker. So I tend to remember things in terms of emotion. And that's a lot of the writing I do is about memory and about being young, being a kid, and remembering kind of experiences you had as a kid.
Well, Ellie, as I come back to you, you know, I mentioned this notion that your work is very joyful at the top, but it's very striking because you're dealing with an area that's potentially very painful, that is painful for a lot of people, let alone millions of teens probably. But I'm struck, I'll repeat it, of how much sort of joy and laughter there is in this work. It's almost got a comic book feel in some ways, but it's got a lot of laughter too.
I think that a lot of what I wanted to capture was, you know, I wanted the viewer to kind of reflect on their own beliefs about the issue. And it came to me just as, you know, if the people in my portraits, if they're laughing and kind of joyful and with kind of that kitschy aesthetic that I was going for, maybe the viewer can take it as a positive thing and not be, you know, freaked out by it, by like a lot of people are.
Well, Ellie, what's next?
I am going to Parsons, the new school for design, next year for the fall, and I'm going in as a fine arts major, and I don't really know what's going to happen from there, but I'm really excited.
And a member of the Scholastic Art and Writing Awards Club. Jack, so are you. What's next?
I will be attending Kenyon College in the fall.
Well, that's Ellie Braun, 17, from Richmond, Virginia, winner of the Scholastic Art and Writing Awards category in drawing, and Jack Rayson, winner of the writing portfolio. You can check out both of their work by going on thetakeaway.org. Thank you both for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, let's end today right where we started, in northern France, an anniversary that marked a turning point for the world, seared into European history as well as into our own.
June 6, 1944, and the greatest armada in military history is assembled in England for an assault on Hitler's fortress Europe, all under the supreme command of General Dwight D. Eisenhower.
Soldiers, sailors, and airmen of the Allied Expeditionary Force, you are about to embark upon the great crusade toward which we have striven these many months. In company with our brave allies and brothers in arms on other fronts, you will bring about the destruction of the German war machine, the elimination of Nazi tyranny over the oppressed peoples of Europe, and security for ourselves in a free world. Good luck, and let us all beseech the blessing of Almighty God upon this great and noble undertaking.
It came at a cost. An estimated 9,000 Allied soldiers died on that day, and carnage from the campaign extended far beyond the coast, deep into the French countryside. Major General Norman D. Cotta, who was heavily involved in the planning of D-Day, recalls his soldiers' commitment to the campaign.
The great thing about this landing was that these men knew what their mission was, what they were to do. And they knew that regardless of what they ran into, they were to carry on, even down to the last man.
Peter Thomas served with the 1st Infantry Division, and he recalls the efforts of those brave men in a poem called Omaha Beach.
When we went in, the beach had been taken. The living fought on, the dead forsaken. We were dropped into water up to our shoulders. We waded in. A group of green soldiers onto that thin strip of beach so many had tried to reach.
And we should note that after the war, Thomas went on to have a long career as a radio and TV announcer. He settled in Florida. He married. He had 3 kids. But the experience of that day stays with him. We thank him and all those who continue to serve. Thank you very much for listening. I'm Todd Zwillick, filling in for John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.